You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
Music has always been a key element of film and television. Often, scores are composed for films and shows, but just as often, the music used was composed and recorded without a specific film in mind. This music is called library music, and during its golden age, lots of great music was made for this purpose. My guest, David Hollander, has written a book about library music and its creators, and it's called Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music. David Hollander, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thanks for having me.
Did I describe accurately the library music?
Absolutely. Library music was music that was made for, you know, pre-made for budget-conscious film, television, and radio production.
Can you give us an example of a film that we might know that has library music in it?
Well, you know, there's, in fact, library music comprises a lot of what we see on television every day. The library music industry, which, you know, just to go back, primarily in the sort of heyday, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, was based in Europe. Nowadays, library music is, global. There's quite a number of American libraries. And so, every time you turn on the TV, you're hearing library music of some sort. But, you know, some of the most famous examples are the People's Court theme, which was actually came from a library record called Drama Suite Volume 1 by a composer named Alan Tew. And that actually was originally used in British television in a show called The Sweeney. And then later found its way into the People's Court and then, of course, became iconic.
Theme to The People's Court, an example of library music, the subject of a new book, Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music, edited by my guest, David Hollander. David Hollander, in your book, Unusual Sounds, you talk about a theme that was used simultaneously by two different British shows.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I actually feel like, you know, there's no exclusivity with library music, so oftentimes you'll have it appear, in many things all at once, which I'm sure, you know, resulted in a little bit of confusion. But in general, you know, another major use of library music was as source music. So even in, you know, films or television that are scored, if you have music coming out of a radio or Muzak in an elevator, that will typically be library music as well.
Right. I always thought it was interesting in movies made, I guess, before The Graduate or American Graffiti, which were, those were famously used real contemporary music. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. Like in Hard Day's Night, for instance, when the Beatles are on the train and they turn on their radio and there's this goofy generic rock and roll that comes out of it. That's library music.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And in fact, it sort of, prompted a need to make what the library industry doesn't really want to talk that much about now, but sound-alikes. So you would even have something that sounded exactly like the Beatles, Hard Day's Night. But wasn't the Beatles Hard Day's Night for the filmmaker who couldn't afford licensing that.
Like, so, they have the same rhythm and the same sort of sound, but notes are different?
Yeah.
Is that how they do it?
Oh, yeah, and you can find you know, library sound-alikes, you know, throughout libraries. It's kind of hilarious when you do. When you stumble upon the library in a Gata De Vida or...
Well, so how did you become interested in library music?
You know, I found some records in a record store in Los Angeles more than 20 years ago. I was really intrigued by the generic stock covers. And then I moved at that point to reissue one of the few vintage American libraries, which was Major Records, or Valentino. And then as a result of that, I started to work with the music beyond reissue. I started working as a music supervisor and a music editor, synchronizing mostly vintage library music. And then, of course, you know, I amassed a massive collection of it. And now at this point, you know, wrote this book, and I'm very much involved with the administrators of the libraries, because in fact, you know, some of these were mom and pop businesses that have been over time aggregated and absorbed by major record labels like EMI and Universal, and you know, they really don't fully understand what it is that they have, and you know, haven't necessarily, I mean, in certain cases they have, but generally haven't, you know, protected the archival assets. So there's tons of library music that, you know, could very well go the way of the dinosaur were it not for the proper archival efforts being made.
By you and other people.
Yes.
So you just sort of, it sort of started as a hobby, you collecting these things.
Yeah. You know.
How many LPs of library music do you personally have?
You know, my collection is probably got about 3,000 LPs. Somewhere in there.
I see. And so whereas most people collected Frank Sinatra or the Beatles, you collected this thing.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, collected it, it sort of came to me. I mean, once I started really looking, you know, at it and for it, it sort of, you know, those things just, you know, fall into place. I actually went many years ago to Europe and visited the various library administrators just to take pictures of the master tapes. And, you know, just assess what was extant, both of, you know, LPs and master tapes. Interestingly enough, I mean, if you're wondering about the rarity of these records, you know, in many cases, I would say, you know, more than half of the library administrators don't even have LP copies of the records that they control. So... You know, certain libraries were made in such small numbers. I think that sort of the stuff that I've really been looking at more and more lately is Italian library music. And there you do have just a multitude of small businesses, sort of mom and pop, you know, composer-driven libraries that didn't make very many records and didn't press very many of the ones that they made, so... It really is like, it's kind of tundra in terms of, you know, record collecting.
And now you've actually gone and you've found out who composed this music and you've interviewed them?
Yep.
Who all did you speak to?
You know, I spoke for the book to a number of the composers of the sort of classic British libraries. So KPM and Themes. So people like Keith Mansfield, Alan Hawkshaw, Alan Parker. I talked to Peter Cox, who worked behind the scenes, as well as Adrian Carriage, who is a recording engineer. I talked to Yanka Nilovic, who is a French composer that did a number of amazing records on the Montparnasse 2000 label. I talked to Ron Geeson, and I talked to Gerhard Narholz, who is a really interesting composer. He owns a label, which is still privately owned, called Sonatone, and under various pseudonyms, including things like Walt Rockman or John Kingpop. He, you know, has registered tens of thousands of compositions.
Incredibly
productive composer and then label owner and, you know, businessman. So it's a bunch of different people. Romano De Berry is an Italian label owner who ran Canopo. So, you know, I tried to cover as much ground as I could. I mean, it really is pretty vast. But, you know, I definitely tried to, in the book, represent things from the various different countries in Europe that produced, you know, large amounts of library music. So that would be the United Kingdom, France, Germany, and Italy.
So the composers who make this music, they just, you know, they make it and they just let it go. And if it turns up somewhere, they're delighted.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, Keith Mansfield said it best, where he said that, you know, library composers have no moral right over their music. They absolutely make it to go out and be used however it's going to be used. And actually, they live pretty charmed lives because, you know, the ones who, you know, get synchronized, whose music is used, it's a really easy, or not easy, but, you know, a very generous, creative outlet.
Now, are royalties paid, or can this music be used without paying royalties?
Well, no, royalties are absolutely paid. I think that that's a kind of a common misconception. Around library music is that it's royalty-free, and as a result, you know, it's been used, you know, in unauthorized ways extensively in sample-based music production, because I think for a long time, when people were finding these records, you know, and making beats, they would think that they could just use it, but that's actually not the case. The reality is, though, that, you know, using library music is significantly less expensive than scoring, you know, with original music something. So
is BMI or ASCAP out there looking to see if that music is being used and billing people?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. All of the things are registered with, you know, BMI, ASCAP, SIAE, and PRS.
So when you say that composers feel no moral right to the music, and it does turn up in pornography, you represented some posters from some of the films.
Absolutely it does. I mean, it was one of the things that attracted me to it, is, you know, its use in various kinds of genre filmmaking from the 60s and 70s and 80s. You know, it's in horror, it's in sci-fi, it's in tons of sort of European cinema, giallo. But then, yeah, it's widely used in porn.
So when the pizza man comes, it's library music that's playing in the background.
Exactly. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that, I guess, that makes the golden age of porn worthwhile. You might find a library track in there.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with David Hollander. He's the editor of a new book called Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music, and we'll be back with more right after this. I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and my guest is David Hollander. He's the editor of a new book called Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music. Library music is music composed for films, but not for a specific film or television show, but rather kind of generic music that could be used to fit a filmmaker's need for whatever mood they're trying to set. When I was a kid, I remember noticing that all of the Hal Roach comedies, whether they were Laurel and Hardy or the Little Rascals or Thelma Todd, they all had the same music. And all of the Universal horror pictures, they all have the same music, regardless of whether it was made in 1930 or 1955.
Absolutely. And there were certain libraries, that, even American libraries, that were just used so widely. Capitol Records had a couple of different library series. One was called the Easy Q. And the Easy Q records, I mean, it's incredible how ubiquitous some of that music is, where you just realize it was just used over and over and over again. The good stuff. There's a Capitol Easy Q record that was used in the TV show In Search Of, which is also represented in the book, and happens to be one of my favorite uses of library music.
Leonard Nimoy.
But, Leonard Nimoy, exactly. But yeah, I mean, there, you know, and then there's finally the sort of the high-profile usages, like, you know, Joni Pearson's Heavy Action, which then became the theme song to Monday Night Football. That was something that had already been used in the UK. And then it found a home with the NFL, who then went on to create their own library. But nevertheless, they continue to use that Joni Pearson track. They still use it to this day.
What about the cue music on sitcoms? You know, like in between each scene?
Well, you know, one of the things I've been working on now is gathering together. I've started a library that is gathering vintage Italian library, because I recognized a while ago when I was working, you know, as a music supervisor, music editor, that there was a real dearth of Italian library music available, and that the only Italian library music was this RCA Italian library that wound up being very iconic music from Curb Your Enthusiasm. And that's Luciano Michelini and Franco Michelizzi, and it's like really great, you know, Italian screwball comedy music that, in the case of the way that it's used in that show, it really becomes a character, you know. It's just like it's repeated between every single scene.
That's right. So it's all
And it really kind of stands out. It comes, you know, right to the front. So, you know, so yeah, I've been working on gathering more Italian library music, because actually I'm a huge fan of Italian library music, especially because it tends to impart a sort of regional Italian twist to what they're doing.
Did you happen to investigate who at Curb Your Enthusiasm found that and decided to use it?
No, I actually don't know who synchronized that. But whoever they are, kudos to them. It was really, you know, a great use of film music. And like I said, I think there's a sort of real future for that, actually. I think, you know, there was a case where you're using a track that was made, you know, in the 70s. And, you know, it really carried a show 25 years later.
This is a really beautiful book. How long have you been working on it?
Well, you know, I've been obviously investigating library music for a long time, but the book came together pretty quickly. I think we were able to, you know, conduct the interviews and lay it all out and get it to the printers in the space of about 2 years.
And the movie posters that are so beautiful in it, are they from your collection as well?
You know, they're actually not. They're sort of things I directed them to gather. And then they actually did get it all and have it in a collection there at Anthology. But you know, I thought it was really important to provide some context. You know, a lot of times the discussion of this music is really focused on the collecting of these really rare records. And for me, the interest is in, you know, the actual world of library music, how this music was made and how it was used. And so, you know, to that end, we included that material.
David Hollander, what are you working on now?
I have a book coming out next year called Star Body, which it collects, you know, basically it's an illustrated discography of the New Age. So it's all, you know, cassettes and LP artwork of alternative spirituality in America.
I have that. I used to have that set of Zodiac albums.
Exactly. That kind of sound. I love the Zodiac records.
This book is called Unusual Sounds, The Hidden History of Library Music. It's a beautiful book. I love the layout. I love all the pictures. And the text is fascinating, the interviews with all of the composers of this music. And David Hollander, thank you so much for talking to us about it on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.